A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. A manhunt is underway in Israel following a terrorist attack with one fatality. The attacker fled into Zer Yitzhak, a small walled settlement of about 5,000 people, with a single main entrance. The question is, how do emergency services handle a manhunt like this in practice, when every minute might count? Not the headlines, not the aftermath, the operational mechanics. What's actually happening on the ground right now?
This is one of those scenarios where the difference between a capture and an escape is measured in seconds. Zer Yitzhak sits near the Green Line. It's a Yishuv Kehilati, a community settlement, with a security fence but not a sealed military zone. You've got residents, delivery drivers, farm workers all moving through. The attacker knows this, so do the responders. So let's break down exactly what happens in those first critical minutes after the attacker disappears into the settlement.
The clock starts ticking the moment the call comes in. Here's the step-by-step playbook that emergency services follow.
Right, and the framework that governs this is what I'd call a three-phase response model. Phase 1 is immediate containment, phase 2 is the intelligence grid, and phase 3 is the systematic sweep. These aren't formal terms you'll find in a manual. I'm synthesizing here. But they map onto how the Israel police, Shin Bet, and Magen David Adom coordinate in practice. The first thing to understand is who's in charge. The Israel police has operational command for the first 30 to 60 minutes. Shin Bet provides intelligence support but does not lead the manhunt initially. That's a common misconception. People assume the Shin Bet runs the show from the jump, but they don't. They take over after the suspect is in custody, for interrogation.
The police own the first hour. What does that look like at T plus zero, the moment the attack is reported and the suspect is known to be inside the settlement?
The police dispatch center triggers what's called a cigar code. Cigar means closure. It's a pre-planned protocol, not something invented on the fly. Every road leading out of Zer Yitzhak gets blocked by the nearest patrol car, even if it's a single officer with a sidearm. You don't wait for backup. You block first, reinforce second. Simultaneously, the settlement's security coordinator, the Ravshatz, is contacted on a dedicated emergency channel. Every Israeli settlement is required by law to have a Ravshatz, trained by the Ministry of Defense, with access to a radio frequency that cuts through all other traffic. His job in that moment is to lock the main gate and activate the internal PA system ordering residents to stay indoors. Not evacuate, shelter in place.
That's the second misconception worth flagging. People picture a manhunt and imagine the whole town being evacuated. That would be catastrophic. You'd create chaos, a flood of fleeing civilians, and the suspect just blends right in.
The order is the opposite. Nobody moves. Every resident stays in their home. Every car stops. The settlement goes silent. That silence is itself a tool. Movement becomes anomaly. An anomaly becomes target. This all happens within the first 5 minutes, T plus zero to T plus five. That's the containment window. If the cordon isn't sealed by T plus 10, the suspect's probability of escape rises exponentially. The Israel police operate 7 regional command centers that can deploy YAMAM, the National Counter-Terror Unit, within 15 minutes of a code red activation. But 15 minutes is a lifetime in this context. The first responders are local patrol officers and the Ravshatz.
Zer Yitzhak has one main entrance. That simplifies the cordon geometrically. But it also means the suspect knows exactly where the choke point is. So you're not just sealing the gate, you're sealing the entire perimeter fence, yes?
The settlement has a security fence, but it's not a prison wall. It's designed to slow entry, not prevent exit entirely. So the outer cordon is formed by what are called YASAM units, special patrol units of the Israel police, who position themselves at intervals along the perimeter and on every conceivable exit route, including footpaths through agricultural land. The inner cordon, once YAMAM arrives, is a tighter ring inside the settlement itself. But containment is only half the battle. Once the cordon is set, the real challenge begins. finding one person in a town of 5,000 without turning it into a shooting gallery.
Which brings us to phase two, the intelligence grid. This is the part where, frankly, the technology sounds like something out of a spy novel, but it's very real and very operational.
T+5 to T+15. Shin Bet analysts are now actively pulling the suspect's last known cell phone ping from the cellular network. They use a system called Angela, developed by the Israel Police's cyber unit, which can triangulate a suspect's location within 50 meters in urban areas using cell tower data. 50 meters is not a pinpoint. In a dense residential neighborhood, that's a radius covering maybe 10 to 15 homes. But it narrows the search dramatically from somewhere in this 5,000-person town to this specific block. They cross-reference that with security camera feeds from the attack site and the settlement's entrance cameras.
Here's where the settlement's own infrastructure comes into play. Sur Yitzhak, like most Israeli settlements, has security cameras at the gate and at various internal points. These are often low-resolution, privately owned systems, not military-grade surveillance. But they're integrated into the police's command and control center through a system called Moked, the centralized monitoring platform. The police can pull those feeds in real time.
The challenge is filtering false positives. You've got residents moving to their safe rooms, which is exactly what they're supposed to do. But on a camera feed, a person running across a courtyard looks the same whether they're a fleeing attacker or a terrified civilian heading to a shelter. So the analysts are building what's called a tactical heat map, plotting where the suspect could have gone based on time elapsed and average walking speed. You assume a brisk walk of about 5 kilometers per hour, factor in the terrain, the known locations of fences and locked doors, and you get a probability distribution. The cell ping gives you a center point. The heat map gives you the edges. Together, they define the search area.
There's something almost clinical about reducing a manhunt to walking speed and probability distributions. But that's the reality of it. This is a math problem with a gun.
The math has to be right. During the 2022 Elad stabbing attack, the manhunt involved over 200 police officers, 4 drones, and 2 helicopters. It lasted 9 hours before the suspect was captured. They used exactly this method, cordon, cell tower triangulation, and a grid search. The suspect was found hiding in a wooded area within the cordon. The system worked, but 9 hours is a long time when you have an armed suspect in a civilian area. Contrast that with the 2023 Huwara rampage, where the manhunt failed initially because the cordon was too slow, the suspect crossed the green line before the closure was fully implemented. That's the failure mode. Speed of cordon is everything.
Let's talk about the third phase, the actual search, T+15 to T+30. Yamam operators are now on site. What does a house-to-house search look like in a settlement of 5,000 people?
It's not what most people picture. It's not kicking down every door. Yamam uses a grid and sector method. The settlement is divided into sectors, each sector into blocks of 10 to 15 homes. Each search team is 4 operators. They move methodically, clearing each structure. But they're not just entering homes. They're scanning backyards, rooftops, and the spaces between buildings using thermal imaging drones. The Elbit Skylark is the platform typically used. It's a small, hand-launched drone with a thermal camera that can loiter over a sector for about an hour. It detects heat signatures from surfaces. It cannot see through walls. That's the third big misconception. Thermal imaging is line of sight to a surface. A concrete roof hides whatever is underneath it. The drone is looking for someone in a backyard, on a rooftop, in a field, or in vegetation where a human body heat signature stands out against cooler foliage.
If the suspect is inside a house, in an attic, in a safe room, the drone sees nothing.
Which is why the house-to-house search remains essential. Each team of 4 enters a home, clears it room by room, and moves on. They're trained to do this in under 2 minutes per home for a standard residential structure. The residents are instructed to stay in their safe rooms, the Mamad, and not to open the door until they hear the all-clear signal. That signal is specific and pre-communicated. Anyone who opens a door before the signal is treated as a potential threat.
What happens if the suspect has changed clothes? The initial description goes out over the radio. Male, height, build, clothing. But if he's ducked into a home, grabbed a different shirt, the visual ID becomes unreliable very quickly.
That's a known problem. The countermeasure is behavioral, not technological. Yamam operators are trained to look for anomalies in behavior, not just physical description. Someone who is breathing hard, sweating, avoiding eye contact, or moving against the flow of the search pattern gets flagged regardless of what they're wearing. The grid search also creates a pressure effect. As sectors are cleared, the suspect's available hiding space shrinks. The goal is to force movement, because movement creates detection. A suspect who stays perfectly still in a concealed space is hard to find. A suspect who panics and runs is visible to drones, cameras, and ground teams.
It's a psychological operation, as much as a physical one.
And that pressure is amplified by the communication blackout. The police often jam cell phone signals in the immediate area during a manhunt. This serves two purposes. It prevents the suspect from receiving calls or instructions from accomplices, and it prevents them from using social media or news reports to track the responder's movements. The legal framework for this comes from the 1945 Emergency Defense Regulations, which are still partially in effect under Israeli law. It's a British Mandate-era legal instrument that gives security forces broad powers during emergencies. Controversial, but operationally effective.
The 1945 legal framework running a 21st century manhunt. There's something almost absurd about that, but it's how the system works. Let's talk about the medical side of this, because it's a dimension people often overlook. Magen David Adam isn't just waiting at a hospital somewhere.
MDA sets up a forward medical station at the settlement's entrance. This serves multiple functions. First, it's the triage point for any casualties from the initial attack. Second, it's positioned to treat any injuries that occurred during the manhunt itself. A resident having a heart attack from stress, a police officer injured in a fall, or a suspect who was wounded during apprehension. The protocol for treating a wounded suspect is something most people don't think about. Yama medics carry trauma kits and are trained to stabilize a suspect even if they are the attacker. The legal and ethical obligation is clear. You neutralize the threat, then you provide medical care. A dead suspect can't be interrogated, and Israeli law, like most legal systems, requires that force be proportional and that medical attention be provided after incapacitation.
That's a hard thing to explain to a public that's just watched a terrorist kill someone. The idea that the same medics who treated the victim are now stabilizing the attacker.
It's one of the least discussed but most defining features of a professional security force. The ability to switch from combat to medical care in seconds. And it's not just ethics, it's operational necessity. A suspect who survives provides intelligence. A suspect who dies provides nothing. The Shin Bet's interrogation division gets more actionable intelligence from one live captive than from 100 hours of surveillance.
The forward medical station is treating civilians, responders, and potentially the suspect, all within meters of each other. That's a coordination challenge of its own.
It is, and it's rehearsed. MDA runs joint exercises with the police and Yamam specifically for this scenario. The forward station is set up in what they call a cold zone, outside the inner cordon, safe from direct engagement. Casualties are extracted from the hot zone by Yamam medics, handed off to MDA at the boundary, and then transported to the forward station for stabilization before ambulance transport to a hospital. The handoff point is marked with chemical lights or infrared strobes if it's nighttime. Everyone knows exactly where the line is.
Let's move to the communication infrastructure, because this is where things get technically interesting. We've mentioned the Rauschatz's dedicated radio frequency. What does the full comms architecture look like during a manhunt?
It's a layered system. At the bottom, you have the patrol officers and first responders on the Israel Police's encrypted digital radio network. It's a Tetra-based system, terrestrial trunked radio, similar to what a lot of European emergency services use. Above that, you have the Yamam Tactical Channel, which is a separate encrypted network for the counter-terror unit's internal coordination. The Shin Bet runs its own parallel intelligence channel. The Rauschatz has a dedicated frequency that plugs directly into the police district command center. And then you have the drone operators on yet another channel, coordinating with the tactical commander on the ground. All of these feed into a mobile command vehicle, essentially a truck with a bank of screens and radio consoles, that parks at the settlement entrance and serves as the on-site coordination hub.
You've got 5 or 6 separate radio networks operating simultaneously, and the challenge is making sure the right information reaches the right people without overwhelming anyone.
That's where the command and control doctrine comes in. The Israel Police uses what's called a unified command model. All agencies, regardless of their normal chain of command, report to a single incident commander for the duration of the operation. That commander is always a senior Israel police officer, not Shin Bet, not the military. The unity of command is absolute. Every radio transmission, every drone feed, every intelligence update flows through that one person or their designated operations officer. It's a principle that's been studied globally. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has sent observers to Israeli exercises to study exactly this integration model.
It works because it's rehearsed. These settlements run saga drills quarterly. The routes are pre-planned. The gate-locking procedure is muscle memory for the rabshats. The PA announcement script is pre-recorded in Hebrew and Arabic. Nothing is being invented in the moment.
That's the pre-planned flexibility concept. Every settlement has a manhunt playbook, but it's a playbook of principles and positions, not a rigid script. The specific geometry of the cordon adapts to where the suspect was last seen. The grid search adapts to the terrain. The drone coverage adapts to the weather. Thermal cameras are less effective in the heat of midday when rooftops and pavement are radiating ambient heat that can mask a body signature. Early morning or nighttime searches give much better thermal contrast.
That's a practical detail most people never consider. A manhunt at 2 p.m. in August is a fundamentally different operation than a manhunt at 2 a.m. in December.
The thermal crossover effect. In the late afternoon, the ground and buildings have absorbed heat all day and are radiating it back. A human body at 37 degrees Celsius can be nearly invisible against a rooftop that's sitting at 40 degrees. The drone operators know this and adjust their search patterns accordingly. They focus on shaded areas, vegetation, anything that would create a temperature differential. It's not a magic sensor. It's a tool with very specific physical limitations.
Let's talk about the human sensor network, because for all the technology, the most reliable detection system is still residents reporting suspicious activity. How does that work when everyone is ordered to stay in their safe rooms?
Residents are instructed to call the police emergency line, 100 in Israel, if they see or hear anything unusual. The safe room is not a sensory deprivation chamber. People can hear footsteps on the roof, breaking glass, a door being forced. Those calls get routed to the command vehicle and plotted on the tactical map in real time. A single report might be a false alarm, a cat on the roof, a neighbor who didn't get the shelter order. But multiple reports from the same sector create a pattern. During the 2016 Tel Aviv shooting, the suspect was found hiding in a construction site within the cordon specifically because a resident called in a suspicious person. No technology detected him. A person looking out a window did.
That's both reassuring and a little terrifying. The whole multi-million shekel apparatus comes down to someone noticing something and picking up a phone.
The human element is irreplaceable, and that's why the shelter-in-place order is so critical. It turns every resident into a stationary sensor. If people were evacuating, they'd be focused on their own escape, not on observing their surroundings. The stillness of the settlement is what makes the suspect's movement detectable.
What about the aftermath? The suspect is caught or neutralized. The manhunt phase is over. What happens next?
The scene transitions from a manhunt to a forensic investigation. The Shin Bet takes over for interrogation. That's when their lead role begins. The police secure the crime scene for evidence collection, the attack site, the suspect's path through the settlement, any locations where the suspect hid or discarded items. Every shell casing, every footprint, every dropped item gets bagged and mapped, and then, within 48 hours, there's a mandatory debrief. Every agency that participated, police, Yamam, Shin Bet, MDA, sits in a room and walks through the entire operation, minute by minute, what worked, what didn't, where the gaps were. This debrief culture is one of the reasons the Israeli system has gotten as effective as it has. No manhunt is considered successful enough to skip the post-mortem.
The term post-mortem is a bit on the nose for this context, but point taken.
After action review, let's call it.
What does this mean for the people on the ground, and for the rest of us watching from a distance?
The critical window is the first 10 minutes. If the cordon isn't sealed by then, the probability of escape rises exponentially. That's the single most important operational fact. Everything else, the drones, the cell tracking, the grid search, is secondary to getting that perimeter locked down. And the reason Israeli settlements are able to do this is that they rehearse it. The Sagar routes are pre-planned. The Ravshads knows exactly which roads to block and in what order. The gate-locking procedure is practiced until it's reflexive. It's not improvisation. It's choreography under stress.
Technology is a force multiplier, but not a silver bullet. Cell tower triangulation has a margin of error of 50 to 100 meters in dense areas. Thermal drones can't see through concrete roofs. The Angela system is impressive, but it only works if the suspect still has their phone on, and experienced attackers know to ditch their phones immediately.
The phone ditching is one of the first things they're trained to do, which is why the cell ping is a starting point, not an ending point. It tells you where the suspect was, not where they are. The heat map fills in the gap. The drones cover the open spaces. The grid search clears the structures. The resident calls provide the ground truth. It's a layered system where each layer compensates for the weaknesses of the others.
The most common failure mode is a cordon that's too porous or a search that's too aggressive. A porous cordon lets the suspect slip through. That's the Huara scenario. An aggressive search that creates civilian panic can be just as bad. You get people running out of their homes, and suddenly the suspect has cover to move among them.
The balance between speed and precision is the central tension of the entire operation. Move too fast and you make mistakes. You miss a hiding spot, you spook a civilian, you create a confrontation in a crowded area. Move too slow and the suspect escapes. The Israeli model errs on the side of speed in the containment phase and precision in the search phase. Seal fast, search slow.
There's also the role of armed residents. In settlements like Zur Yitzhak, a significant percentage of the adult population has military training and may have personal firearms. During the 2014 Jerusalem tractor attack, the suspect was killed by a civilian with a pistol before police arrived. That's not the protocol. The protocol is shelter in place, but it's a reality of the environment.
It's a complicating factor. An armed resident who decides to join the search creates a massive coordination problem. The responders don't know who they are, what they look like, or where they are. They could be mistaken for the suspect. They could accidentally shoot a neighbor. The PA announcement specifically instructs residents to stay in their safe rooms and not to engage. But in practice, it happens. And it's one of the variables that the incident commander has to account for in real time.
For listeners interested in emergency management, the Israeli model is studied globally for its integration of military, police, and civilian resources under a single command structure. The key takeaway is the pre-planned flexibility. Every settlement has a manhunt playbook that is adapted in real time. The routes are drawn, the frequencies are assigned, the roles are clear. But the specific execution depends on where the suspect is, what the terrain looks like, what the weather is doing, and a dozen other variables that can't be predicted.
That adaptability is what separates a professional response from a chaotic one. You see the difference in places where this kind of coordination isn't rehearsed. The response to an active shooter in a civilian environment, a school, a mall, often looks chaotic in the first few minutes because there's no pre-planned playbook for that specific location. The Israeli settlement model works because the playbook exists, it's rehearsed, and everyone knows their role before the first shot is fired.
The same techniques are being adapted globally. Active shooter response protocols in American schools now incorporate elements of the cordon and suite model. The line between military and civilian emergency response is blurring, and not everyone is comfortable with that. But the operational logic is hard to argue with. When seconds count, a rehearsed response beats an improvised one every time.
There's a deeper question here that I think about a lot. As settlements become more wired with IoT sensors and AI-driven surveillance systems, what does the manhunt of 2030 look like? Are we heading toward a fully automated response, where the cordon is triggered by an algorithm, the drones launch themselves, and the suspect is tracked by a network of sensors that never blinks?
The counterpoint, will the human element remain irreplaceable? The resident looking out a window, the neighbor who hears something wrong, the cop who makes a judgment call that no algorithm would make. These are not romantic notions. They're operational realities that have proven themselves across decades of these incidents.
I suspect the answer is that automation will handle the containment phase, the gate locking, the camera feed analysis, the drone deployment, while the human element remains central to the search and the decision-making. Machines are faster at pattern recognition. Humans are better at judgment. The optimal system is probably a hybrid where the AI says the suspect is probably in this block, and the human commander decides how to clear it.
That's a provocative place to leave it. The manhunt of the future might start with a machine, but it still ends with a person making a call.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, the Aztecs believed axolotls were so abundant in the lakes around Tenochtitlan that a single fisherman could pull up dozens in one net. Today, fewer than 1,000 remain in the wild across the entire Xochimilco canal system.
Ah, fewer than 1,000. That took a turn. This has been my weird prompts. If you found this breakdown useful, rate the show and tell a friend who works in emergency services. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.